inspiring and equipping you to live the life you're destined to live. This is the Ascend Men podcast. What does a good death look like? If you're struggling to comprehend that title, wait until you hear our two inspiring guests today. I was driving our camper van back from the Channel Tunnel on Sunday the 6th of August 2023, and approaching midnight, listened to an episode of BBC Radio 4's Beyond Belief programme, titled Grief. It featured Maggie Doherty, who is the director of the Centre for the Art of Dying Well at St Mary's University, London, where her focus is on living and dying well and the role that digital health can play in end-of-life and bereavement care. Hearing her speak, I immediately wanted her on a podcast, so I guessed at her email address, and here she is. Maggie hails from Gravesend, which is very apt for somebody who works in the business of dying. She loves dogs, doesn't have a dog, wants to buy a dog, and has already chosen an Irish Terrier. So come on, Maggie, just get on and buy it. Welcome to the podcast, Maggie.
Great to be here, Alan, and thank you for inviting me, and lovely to meet you both, and looking forward to our chat.
It's great having you here today. Thank you, Maggie. While our second guest is a lovely nurse, you probably don't want to be her patient, because she works as senior sister in critical care at Adam Brooks Hospital, Cambridge. Spanning general intensive care as well as neurocritical care, she not only looks after patients, but is also responsible for upskilling and developing the competencies of over 300 staff. She didn't start out in the caring profession, though. Her first job was a runner in the drawing office at Marshalls Aerospace, where she grabbed her chances to learn how to fly helicopters. Flying solo, she even had an encounter with Concorde over London on one occasion. She learned to engage people in conversation when cold calling for finance company before studying nursing and developing her career in the NHS. She loves 100% dark chocolate, started drinking coffee when pregnant 3 years ago, climbs big mountains and runs trails and marathons. She's a born educator, not only in the NHS, but also in teaching navigation in the British Army. And I can say with 100% confidence that she's also inspiring because she's my wife. Welcome, Jo Beaumont.
Hi, Alan. I'm just amazed how much you remember about me. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd be worried if I got that introduction wrong. So, yeah, welcome both of you. Now, we normally ask a series of quickfire questions to get to know our guests, but time is short. So here's one for both of you. Your employer has told you to take a sabbatical and will fund a training program for you to learn a new skill. Anything at all, anywhere in the world, all paid for. What do you come back able to do? Maggie?
Oh, that's such a good question. I suppose, let me think. It would be something to do with going to the other side of the world and getting to know the people, listening to their experiences, particularly about living and dying well, and taking it back and helping people in the UK with whatever I learned. But it's learning from others in wherever, whichever place that may be.
So it'd be a bit of a busman's holiday.
It would.
And you, Jo?
Well, my first thought is, where would I like to go? And one of the places I'd love to go would be Antarctica. I'd then have to find a skill that I'd learn there just so I could go and see this. So maybe it'd be studying penguins and how they communicate with each other, because I've heard them used in so many, people have used them as to describe things and everything. Mm. So, yeah. I'll learn how to look after penguins.
Oh, that's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Maybe that could be a Christmas present. No. I retract that. I'm going to edit that out of the podcast.
Yes, please.
So Maggie, the Centre for the Art of Dying Well. I'm not sure that sounds like a fun place to work. So what took you there? And please tell us a bit more about what you get up to.
Sure. Well, I suppose it really is living and dying well, because if if we have a good life, if we put as much into our life as we can, then generally our death is as good as it can be. In terms of three areas, frontline training, so training would-be priests, seminarians, training carers, training teachers, and training volunteers in all things related to death, dying, and bereavement. Also research such as looking at 110,000 conversations about death, dying, and bereavement, what people are looking for in life and in death. And I suppose you wouldn't be surprised to hear that they're looking for comfort, care, connection, and community, the four C's. And the other area is public engagement. So whether that's podcasts like your own podcast, which is fabulous, or whether that's roundtables, conferences, and meeting with policymakers as well, so that death, dying, and bereavement is at the top of their agenda.
Wow, that sounds like a busy schedule that you must have there. Now, aside from birth, dying is the only other experience that we all share. So why is it so hard to talk about it? And why is it important that we should?
Great question, Alan. I think the more we become comfortable with death, the more we will be able to face it ourselves and help others who we love and others who we do not yet know face it. But it is a taboo, but it's a taboo that each of us can help break open if we face it head on.
Mm. Jo, anything to add to that?
No, I absolutely, totally agree. I mean, obviously, I see it from the hospital side and the number of people that just haven't spoken about it. And you kind of, your heart sinks a little bit and you think, you know, it's thou in front of you. What would you like to do? Mm. You know, what does a good death look like? And they're struggling with all their emotions at the same time as trying to make it a good death. I totally agree. It needs to be talked about.
We'll come back to that a little bit more later. But so we're talking about the bookends of life, you know, what the start and the end. And a recent UK survey showed that over 50% of pregnant women have a birthing plan and that it really helps with labour. Should we be encouraged to have a dying plan?
Definitely. I think without a shadow of a doubt, there are the practical elements in terms of, I know, Alan, that you like to speak about practical steps, and that's very, very important, because actually I'd encourage anybody that is listening to us today to make a will and to look at their will every 5 years, because those assets that we've built up in life, and I know it's not just about material assets, most importantly, it's about what we give to other people, but it's also that we make plans for our will. Mm. Also, I would say that we look at power of attorney early. We look at who we would like to be our nominated person when we don't have the faculties or the agency to do that for ourselves. Mm. Another important aspect is the opting in or out of organ donation, because it's a generous gift that we can give. It's a brilliant idea, and it's just that you're clear that that's what you would like to do. Again, it's a generous free gift if you would like to do that. So practical steps, I would say a will, power of attorney, also funeral planning. I know it may seem far away to all of us, but none of us know. And if you've written down how you would like your funeral, so whether that's where you would like it to be, where you would like to be buried or cremated, and also hymns, also who you would like to read, and where you would like the reception to be, if you'd like a reception, that just makes it so much easier for other people. And it makes us more comfortable about death and dying.
Mm. I won't go into all the detail, but many years ago, 2012, I went to climb a big mountain. For the first time, I thought, I could maybe not come back from this. What should I be doing? And apart from making a will, I wrote letters to all the people close to me and important to me, and even some guys I used to go running with regularly. And I would kind of just reflect on a few things, and they became known as my ice letters, which had a double meaning, ice being on the mountain, but also ice being in case of emergency. And it was a really useful process for me, because it's amazing how it brings things into focus when you have to face that part of your life. And I think Stephen Covey talks about that in his Seven Habits book. So that great suggestions there. And we'll come back to those again, probably at the end, just to leave with the guys.
I love your idea, Alan.
So obviously I work in an area where a lot of people come in and it's a massive surprise to them. You know, they've had a massive accident or life-changing injury or illness or something like that. And it just, you know, like I said, they don't have time to think about things at that point. But if they put all these in place, it enables them just to be in the moment with their loved one. I just think that prior planning just helps those unexpected moments.
It's exactly that, Jo. And I'm just thinking about the different stories that I've heard and people that I've encountered. So when they get the news, they start putting all of these things into place, and understandably. But that's time you really want to spend with the people that you love. And so you don't really want to be involved in all that admin because that admin takes up a lot of time. So the more we're able to face it and do it early, it just helps us lead a freer life.
And also, I think we need to break the taboo that they seem to be superstitious about it as well.
Exactly.
You know, if I do this, something's going to happen. No, it's not. You know, you've got to dig into your faith. You know, God doesn't work like that.
Exactly.
In 2021, YouGov did a death study of 2,000 adults, and a quarter of the sample say that the coronavirus pandemic has affected their views on death. And three quarters of the group reported becoming more worried about losing loved ones. From the Art of Dying Well perspective, have you experienced that? Have you seen that? And is that continuing now, even though we've kind of almost forgotten a little bit about COVID?
I think COVID was a time that we all faced our mortality, and many of us lost loved ones sooner than we would ever anticipated. And many of us are carrying the trauma of those days as well, because it was a very, very difficult time. One thing, as you've shared from the YouGov poll, that we can take away is, and as Jo shared, hopefully breaking open the taboo about death, and also listening to people's stories. Because although COVID is over, we know that we still need to have our jabs if we're vulnerable. But it's also the more we are able to listen to people's stories during that time and ongoing. But with regards to death, dying, and bereavement, and the more we're seeing people talking about it and sharing their stories about it, I suppose what I've noticed both in this world and living in the world more generally is there is a proliferation of books, of films, of cultural exhibitions around death, dying, bereavement, and the afterlife. So it's I would hope that would continue, because it's something that is rooted in our culture and that we need to put back into our culture as well.
A lot of people listening to this podcast will have lost somebody or know somebody who died during the height of the pandemic in 21-22. And I know it could be a whole discussion in itself, Jo, but what did you experience in critical care and the process of dying in the intensive care wards?
It was different to what we normally experienced. I think one of the worst moments in my career where my heart just broke was the day that we had to turn around to the relatives and say, you've all got to leave now, and we don't know when you can come back in. Now, when you work in critical care, you know, a lot of our patients are sedated and ventilated. So even though we talk to them, you know, you don't get that two-way conversation. So the relatives make it for you. You know about the patient through the relatives telling you everything about them. You know, you build up a really good rapport with them. Obviously, in COVID, they all left and we weren't allowed them there. So it was really difficult as well in your PPE, talking to them on phones and stuff like that. And that made it really difficult when it came to dying with the patient there to have that personal experience, involve them with it. Many a time I would probably ring up the relatives, tell them what I was doing, ring them back, and almost in tears saying, I'm really sorry your loved one has died. It made it difficult for us as healthcare providers because we could feel what they felt. And I was amazed that a number of times, like I said, I would ring them up and tell them what happened. And then they'd be like, oh, don't worry, blah, blah, and they'd start consoling me. And I'm like, but it's your loved one that's just died. But yeah, it was really difficult in COVID.
And I know even outside COVID, Joe, you have reflected on some days driving home in the car or whatever, mm-hmm. and you referred to good deaths. And when you say good, I'm interested who you're referring to, the patient or the relatives?
I think there's three parts to it. You're right. It can be good for the patient. It can be good for the relatives, and it can also be good for the healthcare provider. Mm. And for me, what makes a good death these days is when, you know, their faith comes into it. A really good death is when everyone's on board. For one example that I can think off the top of my head, where it's going. They decided to withdraw treatment, etc. And I remember this one where probably a 30-year-old lady, she had a 4-year-old son, the husband was there, and you're just like, you know, your emotions, you know, you're thinking about everything, all of that as a healthcare provider. And then I remember the father saying to the little boy, do you want to go and pray for mummy? Mummy's going to leave us now. And my heart just went, God came into it at that point. And the father seemed to have it covered. You know, he knew, and he was creating a moment. And if, you know, the mother could still hear, you know, everybody was involved in that. It was such a faith-filled moment. To me, that was a really good death. Wow. You know, everything was covered all at once.
What a powerful story. Yeah,
it really is, and I'm thinking about two things. First of all, how we live is how we die. If we've had that opportunity to say thank you, I love you, I'm sorry, and if we've had that chance to be reconciled with those that we may not have always seen eye to eye with on this journey of life, then it is going to be more of a peaceful death. And similarly, with regards to our life of faith, when we sort of know that we will meet again, that it does bring some form of consolation, although in that moment it is the final parting and it is the most difficult thing to do. But there is a sense of it's not the end of our life, and also that life goes on. We never think it will go on, but that it does go on. But wonderful that you could be there in that moment, Joe, with that family.
Absolutely. And as Christians, we know we will meet again. And probably what to me as a healthcare provider feels more empty, you know, from my point of view, is when people don't have any faith at all, and it just seems quite cold, you know, and that's just my personal opinion.
And you've talked about relatives and family and people mm-hmm. being around. Do you ever have people who die without significant people around them? Does that happen?
Oh, absolutely. You know, for example, I remember one gentleman, he was homeless, and I was just trying my hardest to find someone that knew him, rang up the police, you know, used lots of different organizations to try and, you know, find someone that knew this person from life. And I remember one, and he didn't. So, you know, you're like, dear God, what do you want me to do here? And, you know, like, as a healthcare provider as well, you become that person. You know, and I talk to them, because obviously I've got to be mindful that someone might not have the same faith as me. So I just discuss it with them as if they can hear me, even if they are sedated and not responsive, etc. And hope that through God, I'm doing the right thing. You never know what people can hear. And we say that to everyone. So even if they look like, you know, they're non-responsive, etc., we just talk to them as if they can hear us. And I'll tell them about my faith, and I'll say a prayer, and, you know, I'll tell them what's going on. A lot of our nurses find that really difficult, to, you know, to actually say to someone, you know, you are now dying. And I think, like I said, if there's anything, that any process is still going on in the brain and they can hear it, they can do their last preparation there. You never know.
Yeah.
Joe, I just think, gosh, isn't it amazing that you're in the role that you're in, and you were the appointed person for that man whose life was a very, very important life. Mm. And I'm sure was known and loved in his journey of life, but none of us know what happens at a different corner of life. So it was absolutely wonderful that you were there. I think of my own father, who was a man who was deeply rooted in his own community of Gravesend, and he was an Irishman with a surname like Doherty. But he would pay for people's funerals who didn't. He wasn't a wealthy man, but he would pay for people's funerals when there was nobody to pay for the funeral, and actually have the reception in the house as well, so that people were accompanied, and that they because again, the send off is an important part of a person's journey as well.
Mm. Mm. Oh, that's an amazing story. Thank yeah. you.
So you both work in the business of compassion and empathy, and you regularly make me cry, Joe. Tell me your stories. So how do you leave that at work when you go home, Joe?
You don't. You never stop being empathic or compassionate. That's probably one of the hardest parts of our roles. You know, you take that with you, and that's who you are. You know, it's ingrained in you. If you left it behind, you're probably not good at your job. You learn to deal with it. You learn to relax and distract, and you know, because you can't be thinking about it 100% of the time. But like I said, if it's required, it comes to the forefront very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Joe, I think your role is much more critical than mine. But I think both of you have shared about your love of running and exercise. And I think the more in terms of living well, if we're able to go out for a walk, if we like running, to run or swim or whatever it is, to being out in nature and putting one foot in front of the other, I think it's hugely healing and beneficial. And it means I think we can give more as well. And I also think that time in silence as well, if we can have that time in silence and that time with God as well, helps refresh us so that we can give to other people. We do need that time away as well. And also, depending on our personality type too, that whether we're more, we get our energy from people or from time spent with God and on our own, that all of these things are important and will be important to people listening, that it's where does your energy come from, and finding time for prayer, finding time to relax, and finding time to exercise and eat well.
Absolutely.
Now, you've both touched on it, that about your faith in God and how that is part and woven into the work that you do. And this group who's listening to this, many of the people listening to this will have a faith in God. And when it comes to survival or death, I'm just wondering, how does faith impact your work and those people who you're supporting? I think you've touched on it, but I'd just like to open the door a little bit more on that one, just in case there's something you've not had a chance to say. Maggie, maybe you first.
I think, as Joe has shared as well, I mean that we're professionals, and we're professionals in the work that we do. So that's the most important part. But within that, I suppose that within my daily life, prayer is important. And so that gives me the energy and the purpose to do what I do, and to hopefully be open to new nudges, new opportunities, new surprises, all linked to a strategy as well. So I would say that it is the at the heart of who I am as a person, but I would hope it's with a light touch, because to be able to influence policy, to able to do some small thing in society, we have to know the society in which we live and learn from, because the society is wonderful, the world is wonderful. And so I would say it gives the nudges, it gives the inspiration, it gives the hope. And it hopefully helps bring peace as well, because it's when we are known, when we know that we're known and loved by God, that helps us enormously.
Mm. Yeah, great, Maggie. And Joe?
So more and more, I feel a good day is when I manage to have a conversation about my faith at work. whether that's with the relatives or whether that is with my own staff. I don't push my faith onto people because I'm not allowed to do that. I usually open up a question that says, do you have a faith? You know, I'm very respectful that other people may have, like I said, believe in other things and that. And, you know, like I said, I'm not going to push my faith onto anyone. But if they then respond back and tell me, you know, and it is of a similar faith to mine, then it opens up, you know, big conversations that you can have. And it has helped a lot with staff. The other day, three different people on separate occasions just came quite boldly up to me and started telling me about, you know, their prayer life at the moment and what they've been praying for, and somebody asking me how to deal with something, and I was able to use faith, how, you know, and what I know to help them get through that. One of the big powerful moments was at the beginning of the pandemic, where everyone was so scared, and, you know, the nurses, you know, were panicking and everything like this. And two of the in charges, they just came to me and they said, "Joe, I don't know what to do. We're about to go onto the night shift and everyone is just so anxious and that." And for me, you know, this is quite a thing because I've grown to be bolder in declaring my faith. And I just looked at them and I said, "We do what we do. We pray. We let God be with us through this." So we sat and we prayed, and then they went out there and they took over the handover. And afterwards they said, "Joe, it was the calmest shift ever." It was because God was there.
Wow.
You know, and it's those moments, isn't it? And getting strong. And like I said, you know, I'm learning to be bolder in talking about the things and talking to people and finding the way to open it up without making people think that I'm pushing, you know, my ideas and views onto them.
That's beautiful, Joe. And I'm just thinking how Alan began the podcast in terms of to let God inhabit our conversation and move us in whichever direction. And also that sense of obedience as well, which is such a hard thing, isn't it? Because we all want to run in a particular way. But the more if we're able to start our day and say, "Lord, what would you like me to do with this day? And let me be open to people and their needs," then it's a truly transformative day. We may not have got our to-do list fully done, but we've served, hopefully, to the best of our ability, according to whatever our job may be.
So with advances in medicine, we are surviving life-threatening illnesses and serious injuries that maybe in the past we wouldn't have. And in the case of cancer, for example, survival rates have doubled in the past 40 years. So Maggie, what impact is that having on survivors in terms of facing death and then continuing to live? Is that raising thoughts and issues with people?
Well, I'm just thinking about an example of one of my dearest friends who is 44, and he was rushed into hospital in April with acute pancreatitis. So he went into hospital in central London, and within a week he fell into a coma and was in that coma for 6 weeks. And it was only last week we were in Soho because I'd been asked to give a talk on a similar subject to what we're discussing. And I said, "James, will you come with me and share your story? Because I think it will help other people." And he did. And he's already an extraordinary man. But because of the experience that he's had, and also the wonderful experience he's had with clinicians, and he was aware, I said, "What do you remember from that time?" And he said, "Well, I do remember them saying that you're safe." And I think clinicians do a wonderful job of holding people. So I'm saying metaphorically as well as physically at times, but he heard that he was safe. But he said on that night that it's given him a second chance and that he's going to intensely live his life. And he's writing, he's got a publishing deal at the moment, and he's writing his book. And we're in touch a lot of days, and he said he's never been so happy. So I think it gives people a second chance. And isn't it so wonderful that we're all given second chances, third chances, fourth chances in life? But it's just that sense of to intensely live life, because it's a great gift that we have, the gift of life.
Yeah, powerful, powerful story. Mm. Yeah. Joe?
Just echo exactly the same as what Maggie has said. A lot of people are so grateful, you know, having what they see as look death in the face and then come through it. It being in critical care, quite a few cannot remember it, so we try and keep memories for them. And when we actually explain to them and maybe show photos, you know, we have to have their consent to release them and everything like that, they can't believe how sick they've been. And they don't understand why their relatives are like hugging them like no tomorrow and, you know, so glad to see them still here because, like I said, they, you know, they've been asleep in a sense through that period. I mean, some people get very fearful of death after that because suddenly they think, you know, I'm not invincible anymore. You know, you see the whole range of ages and everything like that. So it just depends on the person. But at the end of the day, it makes you, and going back to your conversation at the start, it's about living life, you know. And another example that, you know, I thought about before was a friend of mine who I remember being at university with. And she told us that her brother had cystic fibrosis. And at that point, it was almost like a death sentence. She was like, my brother's going to die in the next few years. Anyway, as we've progressed a few years on, you know, it's now 10, 20 years since we went to university and her brother's now on a drug that they've turned around and said, you're going to live. And he feels, you know, he's now going through this process of feeling like he's missed out on a lot of things because he's expected to die early. And it was a great reminder to me and, you know, to say to other people, live your life, you know, plan ahead, but go out there, you know. And, you know, we know of some people surviving things, you know, through our church and stuff like that. You know, they've been handed, you know, you know, you're going to die maybe in the next few months or a year. And through their faith, God has brought them through this. So pray, live, you know, and make the most of it because you never know. You never know what's going to happen and you never know what God's going to do in your life.
Exactly. And I was just thinking about George Alagaya, the BBC newsreader, that one of his final messages to viewers who I am sure thought he was a wonderful broadcaster was, I'm not worried about how it's going to happen or when it's going to happen, as in his death, because he had a terminal diagnosis. But he said, one thing I have realised is the precious gift of life and that I want to live it. Similarly, I'm thinking about Barbara Streisand. Her memoir's come out, hasn't it? And she said in interviews that she wished she'd had more fun in her life and she wants to have more fun now and to get in the truck with her husband and go and see their children and just have fun and have a laugh. And she's got that opportunity to do it and I'm sure she will do that.
Well, we could almost close at that point, but I'm going to ask one more question for you to give a challenge to the guys, because we always like to leave our men with some actions to do. So as we close, and from your different perspectives, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how best to prepare for the end of life, maybe with one or two actions that the guys could practically do. You mentioned some earlier, Maggie, some really great ones, which I think, you know, are well worth remembering. So about having a will, lasting power of attorney, organ donation and planning for your funeral. I've taken away your four answers already. Is there anything else that you feel that you'd want to impart on the guys?
Well, also thank you for listening and I hope I get to meet you one day. I think it's what I said earlier as well. So in addition to the four things that you've outlined, that the really every day is an opportunity to say thank you, I love you, I'm sorry, just don't leave it to the end. And if it is the end, don't worry, you can say it then, but just to make it more a regular part of your life. And also, Alan, taking up on your idea about writing those letters, I think it's something I've done in the past before. I've done it when the person has had the terminal diagnosis, but I think it's good to do it earlier. As in, I've written a letter of why I appreciate them, why I love them. And I think it's a really wonderful idea, Alan.
Great. Thank you, Maggie and Joan.
Mine, because like I said, work in an area where things can be quite surprising and happen, you know, on the turn of a penny. People end up, like I said, with a life-threatening illness or injury, and we may be withdrawing care, you know, within 24 hours. So my thing is if it was your last day, what would you want it to look like. Mm. You know, like you mentioned, I like that, you know, when you said about the birth plan. Well, what would you like in that day? And I remember, like, when our little girl was born, you know, all the music that I wanted to hear. I don't want you playing anything else. you know, what would you like to hear? What would you like? What are your favourite passages from the Bible? What inspires you? Who would you like around you? If you could have one last food to eat, or, you know, or one last smell or something like that. And what do you want that to look like? You know, most of us actually, you know, if you're the patient, you want everyone to be happy. please don't be sad. I get it, emotions and all of that. But, you know, I'd want everyone to be loving life. And because the actual impact of it as well, which I've seen, is if you get it right and the healthcare provider next to you doesn't have any faith, you could be affecting their faith and their future. So if you get it right, you know, I have seen some of my nurses and colleagues and that moved when they've watched Christians celebrate the end of life.
Wow.
And that can have a powerful effect, like I said, on someone else's life.
What a great way to finish. Gosh, thank you, Joe. Thank you, Maggie. Maggie, we wish you all the best with all the training that you do, with the research and the comfort, care, connection and community that you focus on, and also public engagement like this. So thank you so much for joining us today. We really do appreciate you. And Joe, I hope I'm never your patient, and I enjoy being your husband too much for that. So thank you for your stories and for your vulnerability as well in talking about your difficult but incredibly rewarding job. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you both.
Yeah, thank you, Maggie.
Have a wonderful day.
That's it for this Ascend Men podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please share it with a mate. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Together, we are stronger.